This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. You can access shows live or as podcasts by going online, kuci.org, and stream it. This is the In the Garden show produced by UC Master Gardeners of Orange County. I am Ann Liu, your host for the hour. This week's topic is home gardens after a wet rain and long drought. I am very pleased to have as my guest Jennifer Pelham, who is the horticultural advisor for Orange County and San Diego County. She is one of us. UCCE, University of California Cooperative Extension. Welcome to our show, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer recently gave a presentation to train UC Master Gardeners about this topic, and after hearing her, I said, this is a show that we need to have for the general public, and she graciously accepted the invitation.
Yes, it's definitely some information that every homeowner should know about their gardens.
Especially after a long drought, we've had a wet winter. How do we want the public to view use of water?
Well, a lot of people are saying that because we had a long winter that we are out of the drought. But that's really not the case. We had a lot of rain this winter. That filled a lot of our water. But there's still, as you can see, that we haven't had much rain since. We still need to remember that water is a limited resource.
And as it gets hotter now during the summer, I think we can be reminded that we are not far away from being exceptionally dry.
Right. We still need to conserve the water that we have. We want to make sure that we use it wisely.
Always landscape wisely, use water wisely. It is not just a California resource that we're concerned about. It's an earth resource.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. For our show, we have some general topics, and we're going to roll right through them. First, we're going to talk about stormwater issues, then toppled plants due to that long drought, weeds, diseases, insects, and pruning.
Yes.
Yes, so let's begin with stormwater issues. We need to improve our drainage.
Correct, yes. Stormwater, for those of you who don't know what stormwater is the rain that is washed off all the pervious surfaces in your landscape, so your driveway, your sidewalks, or any concrete surfaces. It runs off those surfaces into the street and down the storm drains. And where do those storm drains go?
Out to the ocean.
Correct. They do not go to a treatment facility like a lot of people believe that they do.
And that's why the gutters are marked with little ducks that says, going out to the ocean.
Yep.
So it's actually harmful to wash cars in your driveway.
It is, because that soap and grime from your cars that goes down through the storm drain does go straight to the ocean. And as stormwater goes down those storm drains, it collects a lot of pollutants as it flows through the street, so it can collect things such as sediment, salts, nutrients, oil, grease, anything that may be on the pervious surfaces is collected and goes straight into the storm drain.
Now, we've talked about sustainable gardens, mm-hmm. sustainable home gardens, and that fits nicely with this stormwater issue.
Yes, so what we want everybody to try to do is collect the stormwater on your property. So you want to prevent stormwater and reduce it and slow the runoff by collecting all that rainwater on property.
Is the only way to do that is have rain barrels?
No, that's not the only way.
Oh, good.
That's definitely one way, but the first thing that I would suggest is to decrease any pervious surfaces, or impervious surfaces. You want to make sure that you have surfaces that water can seep through.
And there are some amazing types of cement. is that what we call it? Cement that that can allow water to go down into the ground on your own property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some porous cement. Yeah, what
mm-hmm.
they do is they mix it with some porous material, which could be soil or some type of light material like perlite, which allows kind of like drainage holes through the cement so the water can seep down through. Also using pavers as driveways or sidewalks or patios, the water can seep through between each paver, and by doing so that water is collected on site and it's not going to run off, and you're not going to have the stormwater run off collecting all the pollutants down into the ocean.
Another way is probably to build swales or to change the earth shape.
Correct.
Form.
Yeah, so you can create swales in your garden where the rain is collected kind of like in a little I guess you could say swale, but it's kind of like an indentation in your garden where you can have plants in there that like water and drought conditions. So when it rains, they can collect that water and absorb the water. But when it's dry, the plants can still survive. And we call that a rain garden is one way that you can.
Oh, and during the workshop, you told us about the one up in Elk Grove.
Yes, there's a huge community rain garden up in Elk Grove, and if anybody gets up there, it's definitely worth the trip to visit.
The Elk Grove Rainwater Garden Plaza Park.
Yes.
I can't wait to go see that.
Yes, and if you want to know more about rain gardens, there are a lot of videos on YouTube about rain gardens and a lot of information through the university cooperative extension system if people want to learn more about how to build their own rain garden.
That sounds really fun. I mean, can you imagine a little child telling his classmates in kindergarten, I have a rain garden, and here in Southern California, where it's so hot and dry, everybody would be shocked.
Correct, yes, but we can have rain gardens in Southern California. It definitely is possible. You just have to find the right plants that can tolerate the rainy conditions in the winter, but also the dry conditions in the summer.
So changing the earth form in your yard, mm-hmm. having some swales, some beds that are a little raised
and then,
and then a little well, and the water collects, that's very sustainable.
Correct.
It's smart gardening.
It is smart gardening because why do you want the rainwater to go down into the ocean? You want to conserve it on your site for your own plants. So you harvest your own rain, and that's what we want homeowners to do.
What a wonderful idea. How about mosquito issues? Capturing that water. Are mosquitoes a problem in having a rain garden?
It could be possible. Now, with mosquitoes breed in stagnant water. So if water is continuously moving, it's not going to, the mosquitoes can't breed in it. And with the rain gardens, the idea of the rain garden is to have well-drained soil. So the water is going to go down into the swale or go down into the rain garden, but it's not going to just sit there. It's going to seep through the soil. So you don't want it to sit there for a couple of days, the water, because that's when you can have mosquito issues, but as it drains down through the soil, you won't have mosquito issues. So it's keeping the soil wet, but not having standing water.
It was interesting that you mentioned mosquito dunks.
Oh, yes, mosquito dunks. Mosquito dunks are these really neat, they look like little donuts, basically, and they're made up of a natural bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, and this bacterium is a natural product. It's actually considered organic, and it kills mosquito larvae. It's safe to all other organisms except for caterpillar-type organisms or mosquito larvae, and you can put these mosquito dunks in your rain barrels, or if you have a cistern, or anywhere you have a pond, maybe you have a pond in your backyard, and they will kill the mosquito larvae, but they're still safe for fish and other aquatic life that might be in certain areas.
And another way to prevent those mosquitoes are real fine nets.
Yeah, you can put mesh nets. You can put mesh nets over your rain barrels to keep the mosquitoes from flying in and laying any eggs. Also, just overflowing certain. If you have a bird bath, just make sure that you refill it every couple of days. So any mosquito larvae that might be in the bird bath or the rain barrel just kind of flood out, and once they hit the ground, they'll die.
So let's focus on the garden now, the garden itself, the plants.
Okay.
Uncovering stormwater issues in changing the form of the earth, the form of the ground. Let's talk a little bit about the vegetative cover.
Oh, yes. It's important to have some type of plants in your landscape. You hear all about people taking out their lawns to try to conserve water, which is a great concept, but if you aren't replacing it with other plant material, you're losing all that benefit that plants provide. And one of the benefits that plants provide is that the plants do collect the rainwater. So if you just had dirt or soil there, the rain will wash off and can take a lot of that sediment and erode your soil and go and send it down into the storm drains and into the oceans. So you want to make sure that you have ground covers on your slopes, and any bare areas are covered with some type of plant material so it can catch that stormwater.
And also the vegetative cover helps to cool the garden down.
It does, yes. I'm sure everybody can feel that when they go to an area, if they're standing on their driveway with the concrete, how much hotter it is, or if you walking into your garden where you have a lot of plants in your landscape, it's much cooler. You have that cooling effect.
How about trees?
Oh, I love trees. Trees are definitely one of my favorite plants, and there's so many different types of trees that you can plant in your landscape. And trees are really good because they also they'll filter the water. So if we have a heavy downpour, as that rain goes through the leaves, it will slow down that rain so it can be absorbed by the plant material under the tree a lot easier than if it's a hard rain.
Wonderful, and it helps to reduce the soil compaction, the mm-hmm. roots of the trees, right?
Right, and the trees also absorb the water, so they're, again, you're harvesting the water, keeping it on site, and they provide shade, and who doesn't love shade?
Yes, especially now.
Yes.
It's so hot. Speaking of trees, let's go on to our second topic.
Okay.
One of the problems from that long drought, even though it rained, the long drought hurt our trees, and
yes.
They toppled.
Yes, a lot of trees that were planted in the wrong place may have had some issues. And I noticed a lot of trees that fell over were ones that were planted in small areas where they didn't have enough room for their roots to grow. And what happens when it rains, the soil becomes saturated. And wet soil can't hold roots in as easily as dry soil. So just think about if you're out in your garden and you're pulling weeds. If your soil is very dry, it's really hard to pull that weed out. But if the soil is wet, it's easier to pull that weed out.
That's a good way to think about it.
And same with the trees. The tree roots will hold in that dry soil, but when the soil becomes wet, it becomes a lot easier for the tree roots to pull out.
And that's why the trees toppled.
They toppled because of the roots couldn't hold in the soil, but also with all that rain, the trees are absorbing that rain at a very fast rate, and they become heavier just by absorbing that rain that they haven't had for many, many months. So the weight of the tree plus the wet soil plus trees that were planted in small areas and didn't have enough root growth seemed to topple over.
I think we forget where the roots are. Is it a good idea to imagine the root system to be the mirror image of the canopy on top?
Well, as far as distance goes, yes, they'll go at least beyond the canopy of the tree, but they'll go beyond that, probably 20 feet or more beyond that, depending on the size of the tree. But in reality, research has shown that most of the tree roots are within the top two feet of soil. So they're not... I mean, they're not going to go as deep as the tree is tall.
It's not a long taproot.
There's no long taproots. A lot of trees that do have the taproots are typically only there for the first few years of life, and then eventually the tree relies on their other roots to provide them nutrients and water.
More fibrous then.
Exactly.
Ah.
So that's why when you see trees that topple over, they seem to, all the roots seem to come with them, and they're not that deep.
That's right. We saw that in the news.
Yes.
Trees that toppled, and you could see the root system.
Yes.
It was pretty much...
It's pretty shallow.
2-3 feet at most.
Exactly, yes. They don't go very, very deep.
And we don't want toppled trees. We saw the damage on people and mm-hmm. cars below.
Correct. Yes.
It was very, very dangerous.
It is, yes. So you want to make sure that you plant the right plant in the right place. So if you're planting a tree that is going to be very tall, make sure that you have enough root space for it to grow.
One thing I noticed, now we're going into our third topic, after the long rain, it really, really increased the number of weeds home gardens. And we want to be careful with how we treat weeds and use our integrated pest management. So let's talk about that.
Yes, weeds have definitely been an issue. Your plants love the water that the rains provide, but so did the weeds. And a lot of weeds that might have been dormant in your landscape, such as weed seeds that have been just laying in the soil, all they needed was that right opportunity to grow, and the winter rains brought that opportunity for a lot of these weeds to pop up in your landscape. So you may have never seen them for many, many years, and they just sort of popped up, and that's what happened. Their seeds were there just waiting to grow.
What's the best way to treat weeds besides pulling them out? Is there a science to pulling them out, Jennifer?
Yeah, there's definitely a science to pull them out, and it really depends on what type of weed. With some of your annual weeds, now annual weeds grow within one season. One season could be a couple months, one season could be a year. Basically, they grow from seed, they live, and they die, and they don't come back. That same plant will not come back. And those weeds are a lot easier to pull out by hand than, say, a perennial weed.
How do we recognize these?
It's going with weed identification is very, very important. Annual weeds, just making sure that you know your weeds will help you identify between annual weeds and perennial weeds. Perennial weeds are weeds that are going to have a very complex and strong root system. So those weeds seem to be a lot harder to pull out because their roots are going to be a lot larger, and they're going to have underground storage units that allow them to store a lot of energy underground. So that's why they're a lot harder to kill. You may kill the top of a perennial weed, but then it has enough energy down below to keep growing, and it seems like you're constantly fighting that weed.
It sounds like if I have perennial weeds, I need to get that root out.
Yes, definitely. So if you have like one of those dandelion forks, they call them, or it's like a little probe that you'd stick down into the soil and you dig it out, those are really good for your perennial weeds and your sedges. Little shovels to get them out, or constantly cutting off the top of the perennial weed, eventually it's going to run out of energy in the root. So if it keeps growing new shoots and you cut that off and it grows a new shoot again and you cut that off again, you're not allowing it time to store up any more energy through photosynthesis. So eventually the energy that it does have stored up in the roots is going to deplete and it will die.
So eventually, if you can't get the root out entirely, keep those leaves off.
Yes. And
because it's the leaves that make the photosynthesis.
Yes, so it's persistence. So don't get discouraged. It might take 2 or 3 or 4 times of cutting off the leaves before that weed will die.
Knock on wood, my garden has been pretty weed-free.
Oh, that's great.
And I think it's because of that persistence that we mm-hmm. need to show. What are some common perennial weeds?
Some of the perennial weeds that you might come across would be a dandelion, nut sedge, Bermuda grass, wood sorrel, or oxalis. Wood sorrel is also called oxalis. And these weeds are the ones that have those really large underground systems.
Besides pulling them out, is it a good idea to use herbicides?
Herbicide, yes. Mm-hmm. You can definitely use an herbicide. You need to be really careful with what herbicide that you use, because the herbicides that are available, some of them are what we call non-selective herbicides. Now, non-selective herbicides will kill anything green that it touches. What happens is that you spray it on the leaves of the plant, the leaves absorb the herbicide, and if it's a herbicide that translocates through the plant, it will translocate that herbicide down into the roots and kill it. It'll kill the leaves and eventually kill the roots. Now, there's also herbicides that are called contact herbicides that only kill the leaves but are not translocated down through the roots to kill the entire plant.
I try to have an organic garden. Mm-hmm. So the first line of attack for these weeds is probably still to just pull them.
Pull them out. Also, when you are pulling them out, you want to make sure that you can get them before they set flower. Because one weed, for example, one weed can have thousands and thousands of seeds.
You mean those beautiful dandelions?
That every kid wants to pick up and blow. Guess what they're doing? They're spreading all those seeds all over your landscape.
How many seeds does one dandelion
have? Oh, I would say a dandelion has a couple hundred.
Oh, my.
Yes.
So unless you want 100 more dandelion babies.
Correct.
Get rid of them, huh?
So make sure that you control your weeds before they set flower. Or set seed. Well, flower and seed comes pretty quick. But also, you can use mulch.
That's what I love.
Yes, I love mulch, too. I just love the smell of the fresh mulch when it's being put out into the landscape.
And then how pretty it makes the garden when it's moist. Mm-hmm. After irrigation?
It does.
It really is pretty.
And for mulch, I recommend using a organic mulch like wood chips, because the organic mulch will degrade in the landscape, which sounds bad. It's just going to, you just think, well, I'm putting all this money out in mulch and it's going to just disappear. But as it breaks down and degrades, it's adding nutrients into your soil and it's feeding your plants free fertilizer.
It's important. Feed the soil, not just the plants. Feed the soil.
Feed the soil.
Have 3 or 4 inches of mulch.
Yes.
I like to mulch my garden every year.
Yeah.
And when we moved into our home, it was full of rocks, all clay. It wasn't a rich soil at all. It really, truly was what we call dirt. Mm-hmm. And after now 30 years of constant feeding, I can dig further in. I can plant better plants because the roots can now grow deeper in. It's good for the soil. It's good for the plants.
And I have I get questions, well, when people want to replenish their mulch, sometimes they ask, do I need to remove the old mulch before putting the new mulch out? And no, you don't. You just put, if you have, we want to keep the mulch at about 3 inches, maybe 4. If 2 inches of your mulch has degraded or broken down, just add 2 more inches left. You don't want to take out the mulch that's currently there because it's in that process of breaking down and adding those nutrients into your soil.
Good idea. The only time I do remove any mulch is if I see fungus.
Oh, we have a lot of mulch will have fungus growing on it. I think we'll talk about that more in some of the disease section.
Okay, I want to hear about that.
But I do want to also, with mulch, say that we don't want to pile the mulch around the base of our plants.
Okay.
And a lot of people tend to do that too. You want to keep the base of your plants have that air circulation through them. So keep the mulch away a couple inches away from the base of all the plants.
That would be crown rot.
Yes, that's when you're going to build up that moisture level and the humidity level around the base of your plant, and you can get crown rot, which we'll talk about when we talk about diseases.
So as we leave the topic of weeds, which have really proliferated in our home gardens due to the wet rain we had this past winter, it's important to use probably the least toxic method first, to pull, mulch, know the kind of weed you have, mm-hmm. to read the label on the herbicide that you choose, to make it safe for pets and other plants in the garden. The next topic is diseases. Let's talk about what do most plant diseases suffer from?
Well, most of the plant diseases that are out there in the landscape are caused by fungus.
Ah.
So probably about 85% of them. And fungus likes high moisture and high humidity, which currently right now we don't have that high moisture and high humidity, but we did in the winter. And a lot of those fungi got started on these plants when all the rains were occurring in the winter months.
Can the heat from the summer just kill it off without us doing anything?
No, the fungi also likes warm temperatures. I think it's about 85 degrees is one of the optimum temperatures for fungal growth. So if you couple the warm temperatures with water, now water may not come from rain, water may come from irrigation too, you can have diseases in your landscape.
So what to do?
Well, things that you want to do is you want to make sure that you manage water appropriately. So in the winter when it was raining, we really didn't have much we could do because we can't control Mother Nature. Mother Nature was putting down lots of rain on our plants. The leaves were wet. They were staying wet with the cloud cover that we had, and the diseases just loved those conditions. But now what we can do is that we can monitor our plants for diseases, see if there's any lingering diseases that may be on our plants, and then try to prevent any more diseases from occurring this summer.
We were talking about the mulch and how it tied with fungus, and I had mm-hmm. asked, what happens if the fungus is growing in the mulch?
Now mulch can assist with diseases on plants, but if you have fungus growing in your mulch, such as mushrooms that are popping up in the mulch, or you might have some mildew that might be growing on your mulch, those particular fungi are fungi that feed on decaying plant material and do not harm your live plants.
Ah, don't be alarmed then.
Don't
be mushrooms alarmed. Are growing out of the mulch.
Correct. If mushrooms are growing out of the mulch, what they're doing is they're just helping your mulch break down a lot faster.
Is it a sign that we're overwatering?
It could be a sign that you're overwatering, because those mushrooms are the fruiting body of the fungi that are feeding on that decaying plant material, and the decaying plant material happens to be your mulch.
Should I water less then?
It all depends. It all depends on your plants selection that you have in your landscape. So watering less may be an option if you're noticing that the soil is staying moist a lot longer. However, it's just part of the circle of life as far as the mulch is going to degrade with the heat and water also, and the mushrooms may appear.
And Phytophthora, can you talk about that
Yes.
a little bit?
Phytophthora is a disease that can occur on many different plants, including trees and shrubs, and it can come in the form of a root rot, which means that it decays and kills the roots of our plants, or it can come in the form of crown rot. Now, crown rot is when it starts decaying the base of our plant, like the trunk of the plant, along that soil line, like right above the soil.
So when I put in a plant, I have to be very careful not to plant too deep.
Correct. When Phytophthora really loves plants that are planted too deep, as little as 3 inches too deep can cause Phytophthora. So you want to make sure that you plant your plants no deeper than their topmost root. So if you're looking at a plant that you're planting, whether it be a tree or a shrub or a perennial plant, you'll see these little roots on the surface of the soil. Those roots are there to help the plant breathe. The plant wants them at the surface. They don't want them being buried in too much soil. So keep that plant at that same level. We don't want to put more soil on top of those roots, which will eventually cover up the trunk of the plant. And with periods of wetness planted too deep, that can cause crown and root rot in the plants.
Let me just interrupt you right now.
Sure.
Well, I'd like to come back to diseases.
Okay.
Before we go on to our fifth topic.
Yes.
I want to do a station break.
Okay.
You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org online. This is the In the Garden show, produced by the UC Master Gardeners of Orange County. I am Ann Liu, your Master Gardener host for the hour. For more home garden information, you can go on our website, mgorange.ucanr.edu. On this website, you can access our archive for our radio show, In the Garden, and you can go shopping. You can look at all our previous podcasts. If there's any that interests you, you just click on it and you can have the podcast in your pocket as you go out to the garden. Again, it's mgorange.ucanr.edu. UC stands for University of California. ANR stands for Agriculture and Natural Resources. MG Orange will probably bring you right to the website, mgorange.ucanr.edu. I am very happy to have Jennifer Palham here. She's our UCCE, our Cooperative Extension Horticultural Advisor for Orange County and San Diego County. Let's go back to diseases.
Yes.
Jennifer, you were just talking about Phytophthora.
Yes, Phytophthora. Phytophthora is a common disease to trees and shrubs in Southern California, and it can affect both the root system of the plant and also the crown or the base of the trunk of the plants.
Can it affect the roots to the point where there are less roots? Endangering the plant?
Yeah, what happens is that the Phytophthora disease will start killing off a lot of the roots of the plant, and when the roots of the plant are destroyed, that ultimately affects the canopy of the plant. And if you notice a lot of leaf loss on your plant, that could be a sign that you have Phytophthora. And I heard one of our specialists at the University of California call it the Blue Sky Index before.
Oh, what's that?
And that the Blue Sky Index is when you, for as far as trees goes, when you stand under your tree and you look up. And if you see a lot more blue sky than you saw before, it could be a sign that you have Phytophthora.
Mm. What can you do about it?
When you notice Phytophthora, unfortunately, if you see a tree that has it, it may be too late. So what we want to do is we want to try to prevent Phytophthora from occurring in our landscape. And to prevent Phytophthora is to make sure that you manage water appropriately. Now, like I said earlier, we really can't manage the rainwater as far as how much Mother Nature gives us, but we can try to direct the rainwater through our landscape so it doesn't collect around our trees. But we also control our irrigation. So Phytophthora can come from excessive rain, but can also come from excessive irrigation. So we want to make sure that we irrigate efficiently and properly and not overwater our plants. Make sure that your plants are planted in areas where the water isn't flowing directly to those trees and shrubs, that they're going to be sitting in water for long periods of time, and make sure that your soil has good drainage. Good drainage is defined as if you have rain and you have a puddle in your landscape and that water disappears within a few hours, that's good drainage. However, if that puddle is sitting there for many days, that can be defined as poor drainage, and that's where you can have diseases start to occur as far as Phytophthora in your plants.
I think most people who talk to me about gardens complain of clay soil and poor drainage.
Right, and that's the hard is that clay soil does like to absorb and keep that, or not absorb the water, and it's really hard for the water to absorb in clay. So the other option would be to select plants that are resistant of Phytophthora.
How do they know that? You can go online?
You could probably go online and do some research. If you have a plant that you really like, you can go on to the UCANR website and put in the plant name and see if it comes up as, if Phytophthora comes up of one of the diseases that it is prone to.
Ah, I wish all plants were resistant to Phytophthora.
Me too.
That would make my life a lot easier.
Yes.
And I guess another way of avoiding it is rotating crops if you're growing vegetables.
Yeah. So trees and shrubs are prone to Phytophthora, but so are tomatoes, eggplants, and peppers. So if you notice that your vegetable plants are rotting from Phytophthora, don't plant the same plant in the same spot year after year. Put them in another side of your garden. So if your tomatoes died from Phytophthora, don't plant tomatoes in that spot for at least 2 years. Plant a different type of plant, and then you can eventually that Phytophthora hopefully will disappear from the soil after 2 years, and you can start planting tomatoes in that same location again.
How about strawberries? Are they prone to Phytophthora?
I don't believe strawberries are. Now, strawberries could get a different type of root rot if they're watered too much. There's a lot of different fungi that like to attack roots of plants. But Phytophthora seems to be a main one that we're concerned about.
Do I need to rotate strawberry plants then?
If any plant that you notice that dies because of a disease, it's always a good idea to rotate them. Or if they're in a container, dump out that soil and put in fresh soil.
So Phytophthora is a large reason for having plant diseases.
Yes.
How about some other causes of plant disease?
Well, plants can get root diseases, but they also can get leaf diseases. Leaf spots can occur on plants with overhead irrigation or rainwater, or when there's poor circulation in the plant. Say the plant has too many leaves and the humidity builds up among the inside the canopy of the plant, and plant leaf diseases can occur. And leaf diseases can be such as downy mildew, powdery mildew, black spot on your roses, rust spots on a lot of lilies, or even the Entomosporium leaf spot that you'll see on the Indian hawthorns.
What is the UCCE recommendation for treating powdery mildew?
Powdery mildew occurs in warm temperatures and high humidity, and the number one, if we're talking about integrated pest management, the number one thing to do to fight off powdery mildew is to once again select plants that are resistant to the powdery mildew. So for example, crepe myrtles are prone to powdery mildew, but there are many resistant varieties out there that are the least like varieties to get powdery mildew. Squash plants are very prone to powdery mildew, but there are squash plants that are resistant to the disease. So plant selection would be your first go around as far as preventing that disease. But if you do happen to have the disease, one thing to do is try to avoid overhead irrigation. So you want to try to keep the leaves as dry as possible. Plant leaves don't need the water. It's the roots that need the water. So watering at the soil level, keeping the leaves dry, will help prevent and reduce powdery mildew. However, if you feel like it's out of control and you need to use a fungicide, you may use a fungicide on your plants that will help to control the powdery mildew.
Is there a homemade fungicide?
No, there is no homemade fungicide that we like to recommend through the University of California Cooperative Extension. We don't like to recommend home remedies because there is no research to back up their efficiency.
Before we leave diseases, are there... Oh, I forgot. This was an interesting one I heard from your talk. Dog vomit.
Yes, dog vomit is a fungus that we say it's non-pathogenic, which means that it doesn't cause any harm to the plant, but you might see it growing in your mulch. Like we talked earlier about the mushrooms that might be growing in your mulch, you could have this fungus called dog vomit, which basically that's what it looks like. It's this odd shape of a fungus, foamy-looking type fungus that can be a bright yellow to a brown in color, and it just looks like a dog threw up in your landscape. And some people think it is dog vomit. That's how it gets its name. But it's just a fungus that's it's decaying your mulch, which is a good thing. So if you don't like the look of the dog vomit, you can just pick it off. It's pick it out, scoop it up, throw it away, stomp on it to get rid of it. You don't really need to do anything else.
Let's go on to something a little bit more palatable.
Okay.
Our next area we'd like to cover, our fifth area, are bugs, insects.
Yes.
We talked a little bit about mosquitoes. Let's do some more about bugs and insects.
Okay. With all the rains that we got, that caused our plants to grow, which can be a good thing. However, a lot of insects love new growth on our plants. So you may have noticed with that new growth of your plants, you're getting an increase of insects. And two of the insects that really love that new growth on plants are white flies and aphids. White flies are just like they sound. They're these tiny little white insects that fly. They're actually not related to house flies, but they're just called white flies because that's what they look like. And they will be on the new growth of plants, and they're usually hiding on the underside of the leaves. And when you bump into a plant that has white fly, all these little white flies fly around.
I know them. They loved my hibiscus.
Oh, yes. They do love hibiscus. They also love lantana, citrus plants, boxwoods, cannas, nandinas. Those are some of their favorite plants.
What do we do about them?
Well, these insects can be controlled a number of different ways. If you notice your plant is heavily infested with the whitefly, if it's just a few leaves or a few stems, you can prune off those stems and bag them up and throw them away. Or you can try to encourage natural enemies in your landscape that will feed on these insects. And some of the natural enemies that you might see out there in the landscape include ladybugs, green lacewings. We have some insects that we call big-eyed bugs that could be out there feeding on the white flies. Another way to control them is don't plant plants that are susceptible to white flies. Things like English daisies, camellias, roses, and for some reason yellow hibiscus are alternatives to plant for white fly because the white fly don't seem to prefer those type of plants.
So if one really loves hibiscus,
yes,
plant the yellow ones.
Plant the yellow ones because for some reason the white flies like those less. And then you can also use a insecticide to control the white flies. And there's a lot of different insecticides out there. There's many organic insecticides, such as insecticidal soaps or horticultural oils that you can use on your plants, which are contact killers. You just need to make sure that you spray the underside of the leaves where the insects are living to kill them. Or you can use a systemic insecticide. Systemic insecticides are insecticides you spray on the leaves of the plant. The leaves absorb the insecticide, and as the insect feeds on the plant, they take in that insecticide and are killed that way. That's not considered an organic pesticide to use, but it is an option to use in your garden.
A common insect in our gardens, especially now, are the Argentine ants.
Oh, yeah, the Argentine ants. Those can be a tough one to control, and when it rains, they seem to pop up out of the ground a lot faster, and they'll find their ways into your home and also onto your plants. They're definitely a bugger of all bugs to get rid of, because what's interesting about the ants is that they tend to protect some of our pest insects on our plants. Like aphids and the whitefly, those whitefly and the aphids are insects that excrete this really sweet honeydew, which the ants love. This honeydew is a food source for the ants. So they'll protect these insects from those natural predators that I mentioned earlier, such as the ladybugs and the green lacewings. And if a ladybug comes to try to eat an aphid, sometimes those ants will go knock the ladybug off the aphid in order to protect it.
So if you partners in crime.
Right. So they're a little, I kind of like to call the ants little farmers or ranchers. They're ranchers, and they herd around aphids and whiteflies among the plant, and they collect the honeydew that they excrete, and will protect them from all the predators.
It's not good then to have ants crawling up your trees, and one way to treat that is with a sticky substance. You want to talk about that?
A sticky substance that you can put around your plants. So around your trunks of your trees or your shrubs, you can put a sticky substance such as tanglefoot, I know, is one type where you put on a cloth around your tree, and then you so it doesn't harm the growth of your tree, and then you stick the sticky substance on that cloth, and as the ants try to climb up the tree or climb up the plant, they get stuck in this molasses-like material, and their legs get stuck, and they can't move any further.
So we want some of that.
Yes, you definitely want to put some of that around your plants that are prone to having whitefly or aphids, because if you have the ants around, it's going to be harder to control those plant pests.
I see more aphids in the spring than in the hot summer.
Yeah, the insects, kind of like diseases, they have the best temperatures, and when it gets too hot or too cold, they populate less, they reproduce less. So their prime temperature is probably between 75 and 85 degrees. If it gets hotter than that, they're not going to reproduce as quickly, or if it gets colder than that, they're not going to reproduce as quickly.
So there are good points when it gets really hot.
Yes.
It's helping us in a different way. Mm-hmm. Fungus gnats, are they fruit flies?
No, fruit flies are different from fungus gnats. Fruit flies, as many people know, are going to feed on the rotting fruit or the ripening fruit that you may have in your home or on your plants. They'll tend to fly around ripening bananas, or in your landscape you might see them around your avocados, or if you have any other tropical fruits out there in your garden. Where fungus gnats feed on feed on the material that's growing in wet soils. So they like decaying plant material that you'll find in a lot of potting mixes. So you might have fungus gnats in your landscape or in your potted plants that have become too wet.
So a way to treat that would be to water a little bit less, not keep it so wet.
Not keep it so wet, exactly. Maybe even let it dry out, because if you dry out, those fungus gnats will either go someplace else or will die. And another option is anytime your plants, and this goes with mosquitoes too, if there's a basin under your potted plants that collect with water, make sure that you're always emptying that out, because the fungus gnats and the mosquitoes like to breed in that area.
Now, in our in this show, Home Gardens After a Wet Winter and Long Drought, we have one more area that we want to cover, and those are nutrient disorders.
Yes, there are some nutrient disorders that can come with plants and too much rain or irrigation. We talked about how rain will seep through the ground if you have good your soil is well drained. Even if it's not well drained, that water eventually is going to seep through the ground, and as it seeps through the ground, it can take a lot of the plant nutrients with it. And when it takes the plant nutrients with it, those nutrients aren't available to the plant any longer, and you may notice that your plants show signs of hunger. Which we call our nutrient disorders of the plants.
And we listen to our plant by looking at the color of their leaves?
Yes. First of all, you want to make sure what the normal color of the leaves of your plant looks like, because some plants are variegated and they may look like they're sick. That might be the natural look of the plant. But if you notice your plants are supposed to have nice green leaves and they're starting to turn yellow or starting to turn orangey or a brown color, it could be a sign of a nutrient disorder.
And What's the best way to address that? How to identify the nutrient disorder?
Oh, there's a lot of photos on the internet that you can find to try to compare nutrient disorders. But the macronutrients, and these are the nutrients that the plants need the most, include nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and magnesium. And these nutrients, if your plant shows a nutrient disorder on the older or lower leaves first, it's most likely that it's a macronutrient disorder, which, again, are your nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and magnesium disorders. However, if you notice that the plants are showing discoloration on the newer growth or the foliage that is on the top of the plant first, that could be a sign that your plants are nutrient deficient in the micronutrients. And some of the most common micronutrients are iron and manganese.
And if I were to fertilize to make up for these deficiencies in these nutrients, can I need to give it some time.
Yes, if you fertilize your plants with a liquid fertilizer or a granular fertilizer, it's not going to turn green overnight. Depending on the size of a plant, if it's a nice small annual plant or vegetable plant, you know, it may green up within a week or so. However, if it's a large plant like a palm tree or a large shrub, it could take months before you notice the plant start to green and become and show the signs that they are well fed.
We have about 5 more minutes, okay. Jennifer, and I remember you giving some really helpful tips in a garden that has had a wet winter. Plants grow like crazy. Let's touch a little bit on pruning.
Okay. Pruning should be part of a routine maintenance. When you prune your plants, I won't say you're hurting them, but you are causing, when you take off a limb here and there, the plant needs to recover from that injury. So you want to make sure it's a part of a routine maintenance so you're not over-pruning your plants when they become overgrown. However, when we had all the rains in the winter, again, plants love the rain, so they're going to grow. And you may notice that this summer your plants have become overgrown. When your plants do become overgrown, you want to make sure that you keep them pruned, and we want to keep them pruned properly. And one note that should be mentioned is that you never want to prune more than a third of your plant at one time.
That's really important. This includes all plants.
Yes, yes. That's about their maximum tolerance level of pruning. Now, some plants can take a little harder pruning. You've seen plants where you cut them to the ground and they seem to sprout back. But overall, for the health of most plants, do not remove more than a third of their foliage at one time.
This even includes fruit trees.
Yes. Yeah. And then once they recover from that, if you want to prune off more, then once they recover from that after a month or so, you can go back again and prune down another third.
Some people like to have some very unusual shapes.
Right. A lot of people like formal looks of their garden where they have squares and circles in their garden. And when people like to create those little balls in the front of their garden or in their very formal garden, I personally think they look like little meatballs in the garden, which isn't not to be mean. If you love meatball shaped shrubs, that's perfectly fine, and that's your prerogative. However, when you're pruning plants like that, a lot of times you're using shears to do so, and shears can be very harmful on plants when used routinely. Every time you cut a plant, it causes a proliferation of growth. And if you look in a lot of these plants that have been pruned for many, many years, all the leaves are on the outside of the plant. If you look down inside the plant, there are no leaves. Also, when you prune them in weird shapes like that, the rain and the sun can never get to the bottom part of the plant. You may notice that your foliage is going to start to fall off because of the lack of sun, and you're going to have a very sick-looking plant over time. So try to keep your plants pruned so that the sun and the water can get to all parts of the plant, where the top of the shrub is smaller than the bottom of the shrub.
No sheer torture.
No sheer torture, yes. I'm not a fan. I'd rather hand prune shrubs than use shears, but I understand when shears are necessary.
I think in Southern California, we're going toward a direction of more natural, more natural look. There seems to be a move away from that formal garden look.
That's great. That means less maintenance, and everybody loves less maintenance
everybody's
in their garden.
People are always asking, I need my time is short, I need an easier life, but I love gardens. So Jennifer offers a real nice alternative. Mm-hmm. We have come to the close of our show. In the garden, would you like to add anything that I have not asked you about, Jennifer?
Just make sure. I really want to encourage, like we talked about at the beginning of the broadcast, I really want to make sure that everybody tries to harvest their own rainwater and keep the rain, the free water, on site by reducing that stormwater runoff, and having rain barrels and having swales and rain gardens in your garden is key to doing so.
I'm glad you're tying up this idea neat as a bowl, neat and tidy.
Yes.
We have covered so much information. Stormwater issues, toppled plants, trees, weeds, diseases, insects, pruning, nutrient disorders. If you came on late during the show and would like to hear the full podcast, it will be available very soon on our website, mgorange@ucanr.edu. You can also go on that website to find our hotline. If you have any specific problem that you would like an answer to, we have volunteer master gardeners who are there waiting for your request. You can go on hotline at mgorange.ucanr.edu. It has been a pleasure having you as my guest, Jennifer. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
This is the In the Garden Show, a show produced by UC Master Gardeners of Orange County. You can catch our show every Thursday, 8:30 to 9:30. You can hear us streamed on live on KUCI.org. Remember, gardeners live longer, healthier, and happier lives. Thank you for listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.